The Housing Finance and Policy Committee will come to order, and I will note this meeting is taking place under House Rule 10.01. Ms. Hirsch, please take the roll.
Chair Houseman?
Present.
Houseman, present. Vice Chair Howard?
Present.
Howard, present. Representative Tice? Representative Agbaje?
Present.
Agbaje, present. Representative Bliss?
Present.
Bliss, present. Representative Gomez?
Gomez, present.
Gomez, present. Representative Hassan?
Hassan is present.
Hassan, present. Representative Heinrich?
Heinrich, present.
Heinrich, present. Representative Herr? Representative Juergens?
Juergens, present.
Juergens, present. Representative Olson?
Present.
Olson, present. Representative Farr?
Farr, present.
Farr, present. And Representative Ryer?
Ryer, present.
Ryer, present. And Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
And you see that Representative Tice has arrived too. Thank you. The next item of business is approval of the minutes from Tuesday, March 8th. Representative Howard, have you had a chance to review those minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will move the minutes.
Members, any corrections? Seeing none, please unmute yourselves for a voice vote. All those in favor of approval of the minutes say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda is House File 3837. The chair moves that House File 3837 be laid over. Representative Bernardi, welcome to the committee. Before you begin, you have an author's amendment. Would you like to have the A3 amendment adopted before proceeding with your presentation? You want to briefly explain it before we vote on it?
The sure. A3. Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment relates to the last round of funding through the Manufactured Home Park Redevelopment Program revealed the need to ensure greater accountability from recipients of the program. The amendment to House File 3837 extends the affordability period of the redevelopment program from 25 to 30 years, ensures that lot rents are kept affordable during the affordability period of the program. It allows residents to purchase the property if sold during the affordability period and requires that the program recipients offer long-term leases to park residents. The amendment also allows Minnesota Housing to structure funding from the program as loans in addition to grants and allows funds from Section 2 to be used for manufactured home lot preparation. The covenants added by this amendment are consistent with other agency programs, are applied to all recipients of the program, regardless of ownership type, and ensure accountability from recipients of the program. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So the chair moves the A3 amendment, we'll unmute, please. All those in favor, any discussion or question about the A3 amendment before we vote? Seeing none. All those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Bernardi, to your bill as amended.
Oh, thank you, Chair Houseman. Over the years, and thank you, members. Over the years, Minnesota legislature has made strides to help preserve manufactured housing, the largest source of naturally occurring affordable housing in the state. I applaud the work of this committee, who has taken manufacturing housing seriously and worked to provide the tools needed to permanently preserve these communities. We have a unique opportunity with the state's budget surplus to further advance the preservation of these communities and support preservation-minded owners. The bill before you today, House File 3837, will advance the work of this committee and those working across the state to permanently preserve manufacturing housing by increasing the dedicated ongoing funding to manufactured home park redevelopment program from $1 million to $5 million annually, adding covenants to the redevelopment program that prioritize perpetual affordability, providing $25 million in one-time funding to spur innovation in manufactured home lending, providing $10 million in one-time funding to help residents purchase their communities. We need manufactured home community owners who are committed to preserving long-term affordability now more than ever. Last year, 2,800 units of manufactured housing were sold in Minnesota. 81% of those units sold went to out-of-state buyers. Across the state, we are seeing a new class of investor owners raising rents and instituting new fees and policies that are displacing low-income households across the state. The bill provides tools to further the permanent preservation of manufactured home communities and help safeguard housing affordability for the 180,000 Minnesotans that call these communities home. I have two testifiers joining me today who will speak to the specific ways this bill will advance community preservation. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. And we are joined first by Victoria Clark, Executive Director of the North Country Cooperative Foundation. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3837. And thank you to Representative Bernardi, who has and continues to be an incredible champion of manufactured housing residents. My name is Victoria Clark, Executive Director at North Country Cooperative Foundation, or NCF. I've testified before this committee a number of times regarding NCF's work to permanently preserve the affordability of manufactured home communities through the cooperative, resident-owned business model. In previous testimony, I have outlined the primary challenges facing residents of manufactured home communities, issues related to the high cost of replacing private infrastructure systems, the barriers that homeowners face in finding competitive financing to purchase new and rehab existing homes, and the challenges residents face in competing for a chance to purchase their communities in an increasingly competitive and speculative marketplace. This bill addresses these systemic challenges and creates long-term systemic solutions. House File 3837 will increase the dedicated ongoing funding to the Manufactured Home Park Redevelopment Program from $1 million to $5 million annually. The redevelopment program has been significantly oversubscribed in both of its first 2 years of funding. In 2021, a little over $2 million in state appropriations was available through the program. Minnesota Housing received 14 proposals totaling $9.5 million. An ongoing dedicated fiscal commitment to the redevelopment program is critical to ensuring that community owners, both private and nonprofit owners alike, can upgrade capital-intensive infrastructure systems. This bill would also provide $25 million in one-time funding for manufactured home financing programs. This one-time funding would be awarded in a competitive process to nonprofit mission-driven lenders to create and fund manufactured home loan programs, down payment assistance programs, and home rehab financing programs. This funding would provide a much needed injection of capital that mission-driven lenders can use to pilot financing programs in communities where homeowners have long-term security of the land underneath their homes, a feature of cooperative, nonprofit, and municipally owned parks that is critical to advancing the manufactured home lending market. $25 million would provide loan capital to finance an estimated 150 new manufactured homes, provide down payment assistance to an estimated 250 households, and provide assistance to 300 households to complete critical rehab of their existing homes. Our organization has already assembled a network of nonprofit lenders that are ready to apply for these funds and eager to develop financing tools for manufactured homeowners. In the co-ops that we support alone, there are over 100 vacant lots that are ready for new homes and over 300 existing homeowners that would benefit from home rehab financing. This is all to say that this funding would be put to use immediately, creating new affordable homeownership opportunities and preserving existing homes for low-income households across the state. The financing programs created by this funding will also provide a model for future statewide financing programs and have long-term positive effects for all manufactured homeowners in our state. This bill would also provide $10 million in one-time funding to help residents compete in the private marketplace and purchase their communities as cooperatives. This funding would be administered by Minnesota Housing and deployed to assist manufactured home park residents in purchasing their communities, including providing the upfront funds that residents need to secure a purchase agreement of their community. In a marketplace where the deck is stacked against the everyday working people, residents of manufactured home communities need every tool they can get to help them compete and, with any luck, win a more secure housing future for themselves and their neighbors. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify on this important bill. I welcome any questions and yield the floor to other testifiers.
Thank you for your testimony. We are joined now by Ms. Seafelt, president of the Park Plaza Cooperative. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Natividad Seafelt, president of Park Plaza Cooperative, and thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I live in Park Plaza Cooperative, a manufactured home community in Fridley, Minnesota. I serve as the current president for the cooperative's board of directors and have for the past 10 years. As far as the infrastructure grants, when Park Plaza became a resident-owned cooperative in February 15, 2011, our infrastructure was failing. In the 10 years since, we residents have replaced Park Plaza Cooperative's roads, upgraded its water and sewer systems, added fire hydrants, of which we didn't have any at that time. We've added new lighting, built a new storm shelter, and added a playground. We would not have been able to complete these upgrades without funding from the state infrastructure grants. I know many manufactured home residents across the state live in communities with inadequate infrastructure, and that is as bad or worse than Park Plaza's infrastructure was a decade ago. I ask that you fund infrastructure grants in this bill to ensure that manufactured home community residents throughout the state have usable roads and access to working water and sewer lines. Money for financing new homes and rehab. There is also money in this bill for new manufactured home financing, down payment assistance, and rehab loans. This money would help manufactured home communities address another pressing issue, filling vacant lots. Last year, Park Plaza Cooperative missed out on over $40,000 in lot rent income due to vacant lots. These lots are now vacant because are not vacant because people don't live in Park Plaza Cooperative. It's just the opposite. We get inquiries all the time for people to want to move into our community because our rents are stable and we're not going anywhere. The problem is that used homes are scarce and people can't afford new manufactured homes because of the high interest rates and the lack of down payment assistance. That means new manufactured homes are too expensive to finance even though they are less than half the price of stick-built homes. Money for manufactured home financing would help resident-owned communities fill vacancies. This would simultaneously help us keep our lot rents affordable and allow more families to live in our affordable community. I thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for your time to speak today.
Thank you. And we're joined now by Mark Brunner, the president of Manufactured and Modular Home Association. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Mark Brunner. I'm with the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. The MMHA speaks for the nearly 1,000 privately owned manufactured home communities in Minnesota, comprising about 50,000 home sites, along with the plants that build new manufactured homes, sales centers, and lenders. It's the manufactured home community owners who are impacted by the bill. We support the continued expanded funding of the Manufactured Housing Infrastructure Grant Program to upgrade manufactured home communities and housing stock, and believe cooperative ownership is certainly a viable option, as evident by the 10 or so properties in Minnesota. We also support the concept of establishing a state dedicated down payment assistance program, but believe that all residents of Minnesota's nearly 1,000 communities should have access to the program and it not be limited exclusively to serving the 10 or so cooperatively owned communities. At the very least, a nonprofit participating in the program as it's being laid out should have the flexibility to serve homeowners living in both cooperatively owned and privately owned communities, and perhaps even allow private lenders to participate in the program so that there's no preference given to one type of ownership or lender. That said, with the A3 amendment now being the core intent of the bill, we strongly oppose that the owner of a manufactured home community must allow the residents to purchase the community if it's offered for sale during the 25, 30-year affordability period. An owner who keeps their rent increases capped for 25 years will now be prohibited from selling their property to the buyer making the best offer and instead end up litigating with residents or a third party for months over the sale of their property, and in the process lose potential buyers. Under the current infrastructure grant program requirements, a community owner who sells already has to have approval from Minnesota Housing of a potential buyer. Residents of communities already have the ability to make an offer unsolicited to a community owner and certainly have been successful in that endeavor by the number of cooperative communities that currently exist. Essentially, the bill takes away a fundamental real estate property right of an owner to grant a first option to purchase to a buyer, resulting in a significant loss of income to owners of manufactured home communities with no guardrails on the viability of an offer that they'd have to consider, how to deal with multiple offers, or establish that even a bona fide majority of those living in the community have a desire to own it. Finally, the amendment requires the community owner to offer a long-term lease to residents. A long-term lease is not defined relative to a community in the bill. Minnesota Chapter 327C09 currently only allows evictions for cause in a manufactured home community. Thus, leases are already perpetual. So we're not sure how a long-term lease would differ from what we currently have in statute, but that certainly needs spelling out. In conclusion, Madam Chair and members, 2 weeks ago, I had a conversation with one of our members who received initial approval from their municipality to add 200 home sites to their existing 250 home site community. They are locally based and hope to continue to advance that endeavor and participate in the infrastructure grant program. Another member that I talked to a few days ago is exploring developing a new community in Greater Minnesota. And it's these types of endeavors that are underway that we believe that the bill now as amended will have an adverse impact on in terms of someone deciding to invest additional capital if they're not able to dispose or sell their property without it being encumbered by potential litigation. So our intent, Madam Chair, members, is to work with the bill's author, perhaps make some improvements to the bill and really focus on expanding the supply of workforce housing. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, are there questions for the testifiers or the bill author? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bernardi, I'm just wondering if the amendment will be on the Senate bill as well. Will Senator Karen Housley offer this as well?
Representative Bernardi.
I have not heard back if I have not heard if she will be authoring this.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. I guess I'm just really concerned after hearing Mr. Brunner's testimony about it, whether or not we should be on the same page with this. If the Senate's not going to carry it, it just gives me a little bit of heartburn because I really do like the bill. But I'm not really sure how the amendment fits into it. And if we aren't going to have support on the Senate side for this, it would be nice to know if Senator Housley was going to carry this. I would like to make sure that we hold everybody safe in making sure we provide safe housing. So again, that's my concerns. I'm not really sure what I'm going to do yet, if I'm going to be voting yes or no. It does cause me a lot of concern after hearing Mr. Bruner talk about this. Thank you.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bernardi, for bringing the bill. I just share Representative Bruner's, I share Mr. Bruner's comments about just being concerned that this is actually going to decrease the building of some of these, just because ownership now is going to be forced to deal with, or potentially deal with that with the current ownership and be hamstrung in a potential lawsuit. So I'm fearful that this amendment has taken this bill the wrong way, and I just can't support it today.
Anything further, Representative Farr?
Well, thank you.
Any other questions for the testifiers or the bill author? I don't see any other hands. Representative Bernardi, do you have final comment? Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had one question for Representative Bernardi. The amendment seems to require that community owners offer long-term leases to residents. How is that long-term lease defined relative to a manufactured home community?
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That I would like to defer to Victoria Clark, who is here testifying.
Ms. Clark.
My understanding of the covenants that are being added as part of the affordability period to the redevelopment program is that the language that's being added simply gives Minnesota Housing the option to include these covenants in the program and directs the agency to add these types of covenants. So it'll be up to the agency, to Minnesota Housing, to define specifically, consistent with other agency programs, how these covenants are added to the program itself.
Anything further, Representative?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Clark. I think the leases are already perpetual, so I'm confused to how a long-term lease would differ or be better for residents than kind of where we sit now. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Anything? Don't see any other questions. Representative Bernardi, do you have final comments?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing our bill. And I appreciate our testifiers today. This is an important bill for Minnesotans, and to ensure that we have affordable housing for our workforce and for people to call home for a long time and with good quality housing. So thank you, and I appreciate member support.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. House File 3837 is laid over. And now the next bill on the agenda is House File 4269. Representative Egbazie, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 4269 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Thank you, Representative Egbazie. Please proceed with your bill presentation.
Thank you, and thank you, committee members. Housing is safety, housing is wealth, and housing is peace of mind. House File 4269 provides that sense of security to families by increasing access to home ownership. This bill is necessary because it lowers barriers to down payment assistance that are present in current programs. This program is aimed at first-generation home buyers. These are people who have not owned a home and do not have a parent who has owned a home. By ensuring that such funds go to those who do not have access to generational wealth, we can support families starting on that path. We know that a home can be a person's greatest asset to build and pass along wealth. And this bill allows us to provide that specific assistance to those who need it. The assistance, along with homebuyer education, are critical tools for opening home ownership to more people, especially across communities of color. This bill is an investment of $170 million for down payment assistance and will support a minimum of 5,000 first-generation homebuyers over the next 3 years. It is expected that a majority of those supported will be BIPOC households. The assistance will be provided in a five-year forgivable loan That is 10% of the purchase price, not to exceed $30,000. The funds will be administered through Midwest Minnesota Community Development Corporation, which is a community development finance institution. Moving 5,000 Minnesota households into first-generation home ownership will improve our state's racial home ownership gap. We are currently the state with the fifth largest racial home ownership gap, and should this program be enacted, we could see significant closures in that gap. We know that the disparities are stark in Minnesota and across the country. Laws were intentionally enacted throughout our history to create barriers to home ownership for BIPOC households, and solutions to this injustice must be intentional too. This bill will enact some of the recommendations in the research project on down payment assistance led by Minnesota Realtors and Minnesota Home Ownership Center. Supporters of this bill also include an advisory group of nonprofits, down payment assistance providers, lenders, and governments, including City of Lakes Community Land Trust, the City of Minneapolis, Midwest Minnesota CDC, NeighborWorks Home Partners, Summit Mortgage Corporation, Three Rivers Community Action Partnership, Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity, U.S. Bank, and many others. I do have some testifiers with me today who can discuss more about the critical need for this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We have Paul Eager, Vice President, Governmental Affairs, the Minnesota Association of Realtors. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Eager. I'm Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. We're a statewide business trade association with a membership of over 21,000 real estate professionals across the state. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you, Representative Egbaje, for introducing House File 4269. I'm testifying today representing Minnesota Realtors, but we are also part of a diverse coalition of groups mentioned by Representative Egbaje, including nonprofits, local units of government, and other business trade associations that has been working together on this issue over the past several months and for some even years. Back in the spring of 2020, Minnesota Realtors and the Minnesota Home Ownership Center partnered to launch the Minnesota Down Payment Assistance Research Project. Our goals for that project were to identify ways we can remove barriers facing home buyers with limited savings and reduce Minnesota's racial home ownership gap. That project led us to a contract with Rosen Consulting Group in the fall of 2020 to produce a report titled Home Ownership in Minnesota, Quantifying the Need for Down Payment Assistance. That report was completed early last year and provided to the members of this committee last March by the Minnesota Home Ownership Center and Minnesota Realtors. That report includes a lot of data and information, but one of the key findings that reinforced the importance of focusing on down payment assistance was this statement, and I'll quote, "Although there are numerous roadblocks in the path to home ownership, especially for low and moderate income households and communities of color, the lack of capital for down payment is arguably the most significant financial barrier to home ownership. One common way to overcome this barrier is assistance from family and friends. However, most LMI households and first generation home buyers do not have access to these sources of capital. This proposal represents a new approach for delivering down payment assistance, which other testifiers will describe in more detail shortly. And it is informed by the experience and expertise of the people and organizations supporting this bill. We purposefully did not limit our discussions to how down payment assistance programs have generally been designed and delivered over the years. Instead, our discussions led us to recommend a new approach to better meet the needs of first-generation home buyers and reduce barriers to home ownership. The handout in your packet provides an overview of the outcomes this legislation was drafted to accomplish, as well as an FAQ that explains some of the unique features of this proposed approach to delivering down payment assistance. Madam Chair, thank you again for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4269. And now I'd like to turn it over to Julie Guggen with the Minnesota Home Ownership Center.
We have Julie Guggen, President of the Minnesota Home Ownership Center. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hello, I'm Julie Guggen. I'm the President of the Minnesota Home Ownership Center. Chair Houseman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you to Representative Egbaje for introducing House File 4269. The center believes that owning a home is the foundation for personal and community success. For over 25 years, we've worked to educate buyers on the complicated process of owning and sustaining a home. We've carried out this work by partnering with community-based organizations throughout the state. In our role as an intermediary, we also engage in other efforts to drive equitable access to homeownership, like this first-generation down payment collaboration that Paul introduced. The members of our working group represent diverse perspectives and industries, but share a common goal, that is, amplifying intentional solutions to break the cycle of racial inequities in homeownership. Too many Minnesotans have been shut out of the dream of homeownership through intentional laws and industry practices. The development of intergenerational wealth has been stifled by these practices, and the impacts are real for today's generation of buyers. Capital for down payment assistance is a significant barrier for households of color pursuing homeownership. Traditional practices in down payment assistance have fallen short. Minnesota's Black homeownership rate, for example, peaked in 1950. Since then, the gap between white and Black households has more than doubled. Just as laws and industry practices have been enacted to intentionally exclude BIPOC homeowners from ownership, so too must our approach to reversing these inequities be intentional. House File 4269 calls for a meaningful but realistic investment of $170 million to serve a minimum of 5,000 households over the next 3 years. We propose administration by community development financial institutions, tribal entities, and qualified nonprofits, all with demonstrated experience in reaching households underserved by traditional financial institutions. And we call for changes in how funds are accessed by these qualified households. It's in this spirit that I'm here today to speak in support of this bill, funding first generation down payment assistance that is targeted, adequate to meet the need, and accessible for consumers. And I believe my colleague Jason Peterson is next on the docket. Thank you all for your attention.
Thank you for your testimony. Jason Peterson, CEO of the NeighborWorks Home Partners, is joining us. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Jason Peterson, CEO of NeighborWorks Home Partners. Good morning. Thank you for having me today. NeighborWorks Home Partners is a community-based nonprofit whose mission is to help families buy, fix, and keep their homes. I come to you today as a practitioner. NeighborWorks Home Partners has provided over 400 down payment loans just in this past year alone. Those loans have been provided primarily to low to moderate income and BIPOC communities. In addition, we worked with over 1,300 families on homeownership matters just in the last year. This work has also included recently creating and now administering a first generation down payment program in collaboration with the city of Woodbury, which is just one of eight down payment programs our organization currently administers. As a practitioner, I can unequivocally say that given the many pressures on affordable home ownership, any down payment resources would be extremely helpful. But I can also say this program is different. The creation of this program has been informed by decades of experience from practitioners to maximize impact, understanding even in a surplus year, resources are limited. I would like to highlight a few ways in which this program stands apart from other programs that are currently available and are out there. For one, this program has a larger amount of assistance available for first generation families. Most programs do not provide sufficient resources to help a first generation home buyer with the upfront funds they need for the purchase of a home. Another difference is this program has no geographic restrictions. Virtually all down payment programs have geographic restrictions, which make this very complicated for all parties involved, including most importantly, the families trying to navigate this process. Another major change with this program is the reservation of funds. The program will be able to provide pre-approvals for families to allow them to be more competitive when they're shopping for a home, which is necessary in the current housing market. Another major change for this program versus most of the other current down payment programs is, as my colleague Julie mentioned, it will be administered by CDFIs, or Certified Community Development Financial Institutions, who are organizations that are primarily local nonprofits throughout Minnesota who are embedded in communities offering innovative financial tools and products. And last but not least, a major difference for this program is the focus on first-generation homebuyers. Homeownership is one of the most important wealth generation vehicles and still the single best way to break the impacts of generational poverty. Just a recent stat to highlight that, homeowners in the United States have a median net worth of approximately $255,000. Renters in the United States have a median net worth of approximately $6,300. That's a difference of 40 times between these two groups. Just as important as the programmatic differences is the size of this investment. Homeownership for first-generation buyers is often out of reach, and this program makes a substantial investment to meet this need. While this investment will not be able to help all eligible families achieve their dream of a homeownership, it will make a substantial dent in our homeownership disparity gap. Having had the honor of working for an organization that has helped thousands of first-generation homeowners achieve their dream of homeownership over my 11-year tenure with NeighborWorks Home Partners, I'm thrilled with the possibility of this program, the critical support to provide to so many fellow Minnesotans. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, are there questions for the testifiers or the bill author? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Probably a little bit of both. I probably have a question for Representative Abaje, or I might for the other testifiers. So in subdivision 4, we're looking at the use of funds limited to 10% of the purchase of a home not to exceed $30,000. Do you think we have enough homes to make a big dent in this? And this is probably even something maybe Mr. Peterson or Mr. Eager would know. I'm always concerned about, do we have enough rentals for enough homes for this? Do you think we'll have a problem with that?
It looks like Mr. Eager might have stepped forward to respond to that. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to address that question. Madam Chair, Representative Tice, I think we can confidently say there are not enough homes in Minnesota, both on the rental and the home ownership side. I think, our perspective is that we need to focus on the housing challenges that Minnesota has from multiple perspectives. We're absolutely, our organization, Minnesota Realtors, advocating for solutions that will free up the market to meet the existing and future demand that is out there for new homeownership opportunities. But we also want to focus on what we can do to help underrepresented communities achieve homeownership at the same time. And so I think you raise a really important question, one I hope this committee spend some time on throughout this session and in future sessions, how do we free up the private market to meet all the demand that is out there? We're absolutely supportive of that goal as well, but we think it is important that at the same time, we try to figure out how we can better meet the needs of underrepresented communities, particularly our first-generation homebuyers, achieve that American dream.
Follow-up, Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and probably Representative Abaje. Would this be able to be applied to manufactured homes? We just heard about that last bill, but would this be something that they could use for that as well?
Representative Agbache.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. I see one of my testifiers, Julie Guggen, nodding her head that yes, it could be applied there. So if she wants to step in and add more, I'll let her.
Who did you say?
Julie Guggen.
Yes.
Thank you. It is our intent that these dollars could be used for manufactured homes as well as in the land trust model.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my final thought on this, Representative Abaje, is if we don't have the housing stock and we've got the money, and I see that there's a sunset in 2025, do you anticipate that we could make it go further?
Representative Agbache?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Tice. Yeah, I hope that we can make it go further. You know, we are presenting this as a pilot program. We hope, we want the housing to be there. We know that there's still housing that needs to be preserved. So I think there's a variety of options that this funding could be used for. And should it be successful, which I believe it will be, we should look at continuing to extend this so we, more people continue to have access.
Anything further, Representative Tice?
Just thank you.
Okay. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Agbaje for bringing this effort forward. I think that she really did kind of, you know, framed up the situation that we're facing with respect, especially to the racial homeownership gap in Minnesota and how critical that is in, you know, making sure that all people in our state and all families have access to, you know, wealth building opportunities. And I just wanted to mention briefly, like, that we didn't get here by mistake or by happenstance, that our country has a history of explicit policies that have excluded especially African-American people from homeownership opportunities funded by the public dollar that were given to white families. You know, from our lending, you know, kind of public mortgage providers having explicitly discriminatory policies through redlining to the restrictive covenants that were placed on a lot of homes to, you know, the exclusion of veterans of our armed services who fought for our country who were not white from the GI Bill. Through, like, you know, even if you look at what happened to, you know, Black wealth during the 2008 mortgage crisis, all of these crises have disproportionately impacted especially Black and Native homeowners. And so, you know, this is, I mean, we can't be regionally competitive. We can't have a good economy. We can't have a society that works for everyone when people are on such an unequal footing. And so, you know, this is just a really important effort to address some of the past harms that have explicitly been visited on communities of color. And we can, and that we're dealing, the impacts of which we are dealing with today, obviously, as, you know, we're the fifth worst in the country. And, you know, I also want to say that I totally agree with Representative Tice's point. And I know that Rep. Agbaje also and I are both co-signers on efforts to increase the production of affordable homeownership opportunities for people to meet that challenge that you identified, which, like, everybody who works in, you know, in housing or in real estate is very aware that, like, we don't have enough homes. So just wanted to say thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Other questions? I don't see any other hands. Just give one more look. Representative Agbaje, final comments on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers and the committee for giving us time today. As Representative Gomez says, this is really important. We have an opportunity to begin to right some of these wrongs, and we know the challenges that face us, and we know the solutions to get us there. So I look forward to the committee support on this bill, along with support in other areas to make sure that more people have access to home ownership and keeping stable housing. So thank you.
And would you like to renew your motion?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I renew my motion that House File 4269 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Thank you, Representative Agbaje. Ms. Hirsch, please take the roll.
Chair Houseman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Howard.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
Aye.
Representative Agbaje.
Aye.
Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Hassan. Representative Heinrich.
Heinrich, aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Juergens.
Juergens, aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Farr?
Farr, aye.
Representative Ryer?
Ryer, aye.
And we'll try for Representative Hassan one more time. I see she's in
the Hassan chat. Is aye, sorry.
Hassan, aye. Excellent. And Madam Chair, we have 13 ayes and zero nays.
There being 13 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails and House File 4269 is passed. And members, we have one final bill. This one will be laid over. The last bill on the agenda is House File 1790, authored by Representative Gomez, and the chair moves that House File be 1790 be laid over. Representative Gomez, you have an amendment to your bill, the A1. My understanding is that this was an amendment suggested by nonpartisan research. Would you like Mary Mullen to discuss the amendment, or are you prepared to?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. The amendment, it's always hard to explain an amendment without explaining the underlying bill, but I mean, it basically stipulates that the landlord can, Section 1 of the bill deals with allowing the termination of leases in case of lost income. The amendment says that the landlord can request a written documentation of the lost income. And then it deals with some crime-free ordinances and clarifies that a penalty can't be imposed for alleged actions that take place off of the premises. And let's see, what's the last item? Oh, the last item holds landlords accountable for the health and safety of the public areas of their building in case of injury by a person who does not live in the residence.
Members, are there questions about the amendment before we vote on the amendment? If not, to get the bill before us, Representative Gomez moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Gomez, please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for taking the time to hear this today. I think we've discussed a lot in this committee how disruptive it can be for tenants to face evictions, some of the collateral consequences of that, some of the impacts of living in substandard housing. And so this House File 1790 really builds on some of the work that's already been done in this committee on evictions, on the habitability and safety of apartments, and fairness in leases. And it helps to provide more balance between the interests of landlords and tenants in our state law. So I will just walk through, it has sort of a number of different provisions, so I'll just walk through them. And then, I have a testifier who's more of an expert on this than I am. So if he'll be able to kind of come and clarify the things that I may have forgotten or not highlighted that were really important. As I mentioned in talking about the amendment, the first section allows the termination of a lease for lost income. Currently under law, a landlord can terminate a lease, but a tenant, if they're in a situation where they really don't have the ability to pay, and even if they move out of the residence because of that inability to pay, they're still liable for all of the rent collected under the initial lease. The second section requires landlords in these cases where tenants have left before the end of a lease to make a good faith effort to re-rent the units. And in the case that it's re-rented, that at that point, the tenant's obligation to pay rent for a place that they're not living anymore, they're released from that. The third section talks about landlord liability for injuries that are caused by a failure to maintain safe conditions in their rental properties. So the fourth section limits a landlord's ability to evict for accusations of criminal activity. And as I said, the amendment clarifies that you can't evict a tenant based on alleged activity that took place not on the premises of the residence. Section 5 limits crime-free ordinances, which, you know, I think are well-intentioned in some cases, but unfortunately in practice have been, you know, used to target and exclude, especially BIPOC families from housing or from certain communities. Section 6 deals with attorney's fees for eviction proceedings. And Section 7 repeals the state level preemption on local communities implementing rent stabilization policies for their cities. So that's kind of a walk through the bill. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers if you'd like, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We're joined first by Larry McDonough, the housing rights attorney from the Housing Justice Center. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Larry McDonough, and I am an attorney, and I live in St. Paul. I've been a housing attorney for about 38 years, so I might be the old person in the room. I worked in legal aid for about 30 years, but I also worked at Dorsey & Whitney for 7 years, and there I represented both tenants and nonprofit landlords. And I've also been a landlord off and on over the last 30 years, although not presently. So I definitely know what it's like to be a landlord, and way back in the day, I was a tenant. So I think I can see things from several different sides here. And again, this bill is to deal with some inequities that affect both negatively landlords and tenants. So again, Section 1 would allow a tenant to terminate a lease if the tenant has lost income and can no longer pay the rent. And as Representative Gomez was saying, the landlord can evict right now for non-payment of rent, but it doesn't allow the tenant to essentially avoid the eviction and terminate the lease. And this really kind of came to a head in the pandemic, where many tenants had lost income, asked their landlords to terminate leases, and had landlords just say, no, I'm not going to terminate, and you're going to stay liable whether you stay or move. And so to me, it just seems fair that if I as a landlord could evict for non-payment of rent, that the tenant should have that ability to get out of the obligation and not owe the rent. I mean, in either setting, I end up getting another tenant who hopefully can pay the rent, but without an eviction following the tenant around. And the amendment would simply allow the landlord to request documentation if the tenant has it, and if the tenant doesn't have it, to provide a written explanation. I could see a situation where a tenant would lose a job and say, I need to get out of the lease. The landlord would say, well, can I have some documentation? They go back to the employer, and the employer says, I don't have to do that. And so then the tenant could give an explanation of the loss of income. So Section 2 is getting at the issue of what us lawyers call mitigation of damages. So other parties to contracts, all kinds of contracts, have this obligation to mitigate damages when faced with a breach. So what that means is cut your losses. I mean, if someone doesn't supply a commodity to you, one of your obligations as that purchaser would be to try to cut your losses by getting that commodity from somewhere else. And if you end up paying more for that, then that would be your damage, but your damage would be less than if you never got that commodity. And so that's the obligation to mitigate damages. The case law out there doesn't require landlords to do that. So they're really the outlier in terms of contract parties. And this would simply put landlords in the same position as other contract parties. William Dane from the University of Minnesota Student Legal Service will testify in a little more detail about this when I'm done. So Section 3 of the bill really gets at this disconnection between court decisions limiting landlord liability for personal injuries caused by failing to maintain the property, that disconnection with both other areas of personal injury law, but also our own laws on habitability. Older court decisions, going back to the 1800s, said that a landlord did not have liability for injuries unless certain factors were present. And one of those factors was if the landlord had agreed to repair the property. And so these cases go back a long ways. So in 1971, the legislature created the contractual obligation for landlords to maintain the property. And that's what we call the covenants of habitability. It's presently in 504B161. But unfortunately, a number of appellate decisions going back to the mid-80s interpreted this law as not changing this general lack of liability for injuries on the property, even though the statute created the landlord obligation to do it. And some of these cases are really very sad. A child of tenants developed a serious disease with permanent neurological damage, and there was evidence that was from toxic poisoning from formaldehyde exposure. And the court held the landlord had no liability, even though 504B161 required the landlord to maintain the property. And we've seen other cases like that as well. So what Section 3 would do is essentially put landlords in the position with other types of parties. You know, if I run my car into somebody else's car and I'm negligent in doing that, I'm going to have some liability for that. And there isn't a area of the law that just says, because I'm an attorney and I'm driving this kind of car, I don't have that kind of risk. And what this bill would do is it would create an incentive for the insurance industry to offer lower rates for landlords who maintain their properties and higher rates for those who don't. And so there would be a financial incentive for the landlord to maintain the property. So Sections 4 and 5 deal with evictions of certain types of alleged petty misdemeanor and criminal conduct. Right now, Minnesota Statute 504B161 allows for eviction of a tenant for possession of a small amount of marijuana on the property, regardless of whether the tenant consumes or not, even though that possession is a petty misdemeanor, like driving over the speed limit. So what Section 4 would do is limit 504B161 to actual criminal conduct on the property and not non-criminal offenses. And as the legislature considers decriminalization of some marijuana activity, tenants should not be at risk of eviction for a non-criminal use of marijuana. And again, Section 5 deals with crime-free ordinances, and they've been in the press a bit. St. Louis Park got rid of theirs. Bloomington got rid of theirs. Albert Lea got rid of theirs. But what these do is they essentially allow the police to say to a landlord, we believe there's been some offenses of your tenant household on or off the property. And if you want to keep your license, you have to evict them. And so then the landlords, for the most part, don't like these, but still feel like they're at a rock and a hard place to do that. And what we found in St. Louis Park is that a lot of these kind of pressure on landlords to evict were in cases where the city was not prosecuting for the offense. So it's almost like we think this tenant's doing something, but we maybe don't have enough to do, or maybe a teenage member of that household, but we don't have enough to prosecute, but we're still gonna make you evict in order to keep your license. You know, mortgage banks aren't required to foreclose on mortgages of homeowners who might have suspected offense conduct on or off the property. As a former landlord, I never thought it was fair for the police to force me to deal with alleged offenses off my properties. I mean, if there's activity on my property that violates my lease, I was certainly going to deal with that. And so, and there's an amendment here that essentially provides some clarifying language to what was in the original bill. Okay, so I'm just about done. Section 6 would correct some Minnesota court decisions on the issue of attorney's fees, and could be not a lot of people care about that, but the current law allows the landlord to recover attorney's fees if the landlord has a provision in the lease, if they win an eviction case for any reason. But the court interpretation of 504B172 limits that on the tenant side only if the tenant wins on the merits of the case, not for procedural reasons. And so that would kind of take away that distinction. And finally, Section 7 would deal with, would repeal 471.9996, the preemption statute on rent stabilization. And it really prevents cities from deciding for themselves whether to have rent control or not. It has some exceptions. It's a very kind of onerous set of exceptions to navigate. Citizens in Minneapolis, St. Paul were able to navigate that and pass rent stabilization. There are a lot of different opinions on rent stabilization. I get that. But it has been around the country for a long time. The cities that have rent stabilization have not declined. So what this would do is allow, you know, the citizens of cities to decide on their own what they think is best for them. And Tram Hung, the director of policy and research for the Housing Justice Center, couldn't be here today, but she submitted a letter in support of this section. I'll take a breath now.
Thank you. We're joined now by William Dame, the senior staff attorney from the University of Minnesota Student Legal Services. Representative Heinrich, if you're okay, I would like to take the testimony and then we'll go to member questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Dame, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee. I've testified before this committee before as an attorney for a student legal service, and I must look different because usually I have students on either side of me from the Minnesota Student Association. So that's the reason I'm testifying here today, is because I've been working with the Student Association over the past several years, trying to push some initiatives that will improve housing standards and the issues that pertain primarily to students. But a lot of those issues have really statewide consequences. I wanted to come here today to talk about specifically Section 2 of the proposal here today, which is called the tenant abandonment out of a dwelling. And as Mr. McDonough just said, that's really a mitigation issue. That's what we call it in the law. And when I met with the students this year, excuse me, I'm having a difficult time here. If I can figure out how to apologize for this. And that is a relative calling from Norway on Skype, I think. And so their time is a little different than ours. Anyway, the students identified two issues, and one of them actually shows up in the proposals here today, and that is the mitigation of damages when there is a rent gap. Students, for all sorts of reasons, oftentimes have to end leases early. And we have a really good core of landlords in the university district who acknowledge that for the most part and really work hard with students to get the properties rented to someone else so there aren't damages. But there are situations that come up on a not that infrequent basis where landlords just choose not to do that. And our law really doesn't address what happens if a landlord just says, no, I'm not going to make an effort to rent. I'm just going to keep charging you. So when the students raised this issue, SLS, the student legal service that I work for, decided to do some research. And we had our law clerk do a 50-state survey of the laws pertaining to mitigation in that kind of a circumstance. And what we found was kind of almost shocking. 49 states have law on the books or have case law that specifically identifies what the parties are supposed to do in that circumstance. There's only one that doesn't, and we live in it, Minnesota. And so it is a big gap in our law. It's something that we should be interested in addressing in some way, both to give tenants and landlords some certainty about how it should work if a tenant has to leave the property early. We had literally hundreds and hundreds of students who had to leave leases early during the pandemic. It was really a difficult process, but we worked with a lot of landlords, and for the most part, those cases got worked out, and I'm really happy to be able to say that. But it was all made more difficult because there was so much uncertainty in our law. And it gets really, really more difficult when you consider that around the university now, there are just hundreds and hundreds of new units that go into service each year. Most of those are not owned by local ownership, and many of them do not have local attorneys who understand Minnesota law or Minnesota practices. And so they're all just kind of shooting in the dark in terms of what the expectations are. But we can really address that with this Section 2 language. One of the things I would note is Section 2 requires a landlord to make reasonable efforts. And that's the majority of the states that we surveyed have something in their law that says make a reasonable effort. Doesn't usually define it as you have to do this, this, and this. But I think we can trust the courts in the state of Minnesota to figure out what's a reasonable effort. We experienced some cases just in the past year at Student Legal Service where there was no reasonable effort. And one of those was a case where a group of students had rented a tier 3 property in Minneapolis. For those of you unfamiliar with the tier system in Minneapolis, tier 3 is the worst. I mean, it means that you're just within inches of losing your license. And they didn't know that it was a tier 3 property when they rented it. But when they started living in it, they figured out pretty quickly that the property had tons of issues and they needed to break their lease early. But the landlord in that case held that lease over their head for 7 or 8 months after they vacated, making it very difficult for them and their families to plan for what was going to be their housing for the rest of the year, for the next year. It was very difficult, but it all got worked out in the end. I'm not saying that these cases can't be worked out in the absence of a statute that requires some mitigation, but it's going to be easier for both sides if there's some standards to work with. So that's one of the reasons why that particular case is one of the reasons why the students got excited about pushing for some mitigation standards in the Minnesota law. Let's see.
We have two more testifiers, so okay. I don't know.
I can finish up very quickly here. The other point I just wanted to raise, and this is the one that's important to students. So I'm hoping that as you look at what's being proposed, that you'll give a special eye to this, because I think this is the one that would really help the students the most. But Section 6, the one that deals with attorney's fees, just wanted to make a quick comment on that. As an attorney who's been doing tenant representation for 40 years, it would be very helpful to have the mutuality spelled out in the law where everybody understands if one party is entitled to ask for attorney's fees, then the other certainly is too. So thank you for your time. I appreciate
it. Thank you. Yes, members are anxious to get to questions. So we have two more testifiers, but definitely we will get to member questions as well. Cecil Smith, President and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, is with us. Welcome. And please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cecil Smith. I am President and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. MHA is an industry nonprofit representing 1,800 members and over 300,000 rental housing units in the state. I'm here today to respectfully raise MHA's opposition to House File 1790. Under Section 1 of the proposal, it allows a renter to terminate their lease, quote, if the tenant has lost income and could no longer pay the rent. Under this section, there's no requirement for a renter to provide evidence that they have seen a reduction or total loss of income. As drafted, this section would offer housing providers no proven justification. And an end of lease could possibly be by a personal decision of a resident to reduce hours or quit their job. And as we just got the A1 amendment, by their own written statement. There are significant costs associated with preparing an apartment for the next resident, which includes marketing, cleaning, rekeying, and the cost of lost rent while finding the next resident. Having a new resident move in during winter months or the holiday season can be very difficult for many operators in Minnesota as they attempt to have their leases end during the summer months. These aspects can contribute to a longer time needed to fill the unit. These additional costs will in the end result in higher rates of rent to offset these costs. This is even more problematic in rent-controlled cities. With an immediate effective date, this language would be a clear impairment of current contracts. Under Section 2 of the bill, this is another attempt to undermine contract law and lessen the value of a lease. This section of the bill says the agreement is terminated when the landlord has notice of abandonment. This is an unusual requirement because it doesn't provide how a notice should be provided. We would ask the author to provide further details on what a notice should look like and what would be a definition of abandonment for this section. As with Section 1 of these types of policies, it would invite bad actors to take advantage of these provisions, and the costs associated would again be passed on to other renters. Section 3 of the proposal creates a separate right of action or grounds for liability for injury if the tenant or guest claims some injury happened due to the housing provider's failure to repair or maintain the apartment or common area. This section of law is unnecessary, confusing, and in addition to negligence law. Common law of negligence would already give a tenant or potentially a guest a claim against a property owner for not using due care to maintain the property. This new language would appear to provide that if, say, a pet damages a carpet and creates a potential tripping hazard in a residence unit and a guest of the resident trips and injures themselves, then currently the host, that's the resident, would be liable. This bill clouds responsibility with its language, as the tenant could assert that the landlord had a duty to repair. This statute does not address whether or not the tenant allowed access, the tenant gave notice of repair, and whether or not the landlord might be responsible for the damage because of the tenant or the tenant's animals caused the damage. We are seriously concerned with the additional implications this adds to liability under the law. The limitation of crime-free ordinances in Section 5 has raised concerns for housing providers. We learned many lessons during the COVID-19 eviction moratorium. Chief among them is the importance of having tools that we need to deal with unruly residents or their guests. This section would look to limit a property manager's ability to terminate a lease or impose penalties for conduct that occurs off the premises. During the moratorium, I had a situation on my property where I was physically assaulted by a guest of a resident. While the eviction was not permitted during that period of the moratorium, had I been 20 feet over in the public right-of-way, I would not be able to terminate their lease, according to this section. That said, Section 5 is still up for interpretation, as the section states it is for conduct of the tenant or the guest that occurred away from the premises or the common areas or the curtilage of the premises. I have no recommendation for how this should be written, but as it stands, it seems it could be interpreted several ways. And this section will make our housing in our communities less safe. We're deeply concerned by the repeal of the rent control preemption. Rent control comes with many promises, but many unintended negative consequences. In St. Paul, we see those unintended consequences coming to life. Since the policy was passed in November 2021, St. Paul has seen housing chaos. Conservatively, we have an estimated 3,100 units that have been paused or canceled in St. Paul, accounting for nearly $1 billion of private investment. If adopted, this policy would put a big red X over Minnesota for national investors and depress housing investment here. St. Paul's policy has proven that rent control will only worsen the housing crisis by stopping new housing development and redirecting investment to other states. Instead of looking to make it easier to adopt rent control, we believe the legislature should look to a complete preemption of rent control and end the uncertainty. Overall, this bill creates new risks for rental housing through the deterioration of rental contracts, adding new liabilities for housing providers, and reducing a property owner's ability to manage their housing to ensure it is safe for residents. It also allows cities to adopt destructive rent control at will. This is a housing proposal which creates no new housing, makes managing housing more difficult, and could depress new housing development. I ask members to oppose the bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And finally, we're joined by Matt Spellman, the Director of Governmental Affairs from the Minnesota Realtors. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Matt Spellman. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors. I'm going to limit my comments in the interest of time and echo a lot of the things that Mr. Smith just said. You know, we believe that rent control is just not the answer to our current housing challenges. You know, we need more housing of all types to meet current demand. You can pick up a newspaper on, you know, any given day of the week, and you're going to see that we are lacking in supply of all types. You know, unfortunately, both St. Paul and Minneapolis both passed ballot measures of rent control last November. And over the past several months, you're going to see, you've seen, you know, numerous reports in the media that property owners, developers, and lenders have responded rationally by either raising rents or pausing projects, specifically in St. Paul. You know, the Senate Housing Finance and Policy Committee held a hearing, an overview hearing on the impacts of rent control in St. Paul and Minneapolis 2 weeks ago. You know, a number of testifiers shared the real world impacts of these policies. One of our members who is a realtor and a developer shared some of his, you know, his real world experience. He said that he purchases blighted multifamily units, renovates them, provides people with a nice place to live at or below market rate. He wanted to emphasize that point. You know, he said after these ballot measures were enacted, you know, he's no longer looking in St. Paul, Minneapolis to invest in any more units. Madam Chair, again, thank you, you know, for the opportunity to testify. We don't think rent control is, you know, is the right approach. Instead, we think we need to focus on how we can create more housing of all types in Minnesota, more units that are broadly affordable to more people. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Representative Heinrich, to your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the interest of time, I'll be quicker and not ask all the questions I had. I see there's other members, too, that want to ask some questions. But one concern I had was landlords being held responsible for crime in common areas. But at the same time, we're kind of saying that, you know, if somebody commits a crime with a knife out on just outside the property, then it seems that we're restricting the ability for that landlord to protect the people that live there, their tenants. So I think that those two measures seem to kind of work against each other. Maybe I'd be happy to talk with Chair Gomez offline a little bit more in depth about that issue. I'll also just say that I appreciate the comments and wholeheartedly agree with Mr. Smith's comments. And then, you know, another big problem I have is the rent control or the repealer here on this. I do believe that we should have complete preemption of rent control. I think it's a Garofalo bill, House File 2308, for any member that's interested in looking at that bill, House File 2308. I just signed on yesterday, actually, to that Garofalo bill. So I'm just concerned that some of the things that we're doing out of the goodness of our heart and good intentions are going to actually have the wrong effect. And so, again, I'll just echo the comments of Mr. Spellman and Mr. Smith as far as that goes and let the other members comment. Thank you for the time, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will pick one part of the bill and let other members question. You know, I think it's Section 2, abandonment. My question there is that if the unit is abandoned and then the housing provider has to do reasonable efforts to rent that unit again, does this take into account, let's say, the housing provider might have 100 available units. Somebody abandons it, that puts it to 101 available units. If by chance he rents that unit, now he is out rent the possibility of renting another one of his open units. So if he has an inventory of available units, but he has to rent that one first, he's still out that unit's rent. I mean, I hope you're taking that into account. I don't see it anywhere in this bill. Also, the additional expenses for marketing for that unit, that I think that
that the whole section there is really problematic. And I'd like you to look at if there's any way we could to take into account the other available units. And just in closing, the repealer, we see how well that's working for St. Paul, the rent control. 3,100 units, holy cow. That's a big number. And again, Madam Chair, the bills coming this committee are systematically taking out of the affordable housing units. That we're penalizing people who want to bring units to the market. Instead, you're increasing the liability to them and the mandates. And you're chasing people away from the housing market. So instead of increasing affordable units, we're decreasing the inventory, and it's not doing what we intended to do. So I know that this is what the Democrats want to do, but I just have a problem with it. And again, I will be voting no. Thank you.
This bill is going to be laid over. Did that conclude your comments, Representative Bliss?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, just some comments, not really, I don't think any questions, but one of the things I'm worried about, again, as we heard, is the cost of now being a housing provider and what that means. We saw the radon bill, was it last week or so? Representative Ryer had that, and we didn't see any money to that. And mitigation on 120 unit, checking with some of my friends, is going to start at $50,000. And when I look at this, I'm like, wow, this is just really going to have a hard, hard time for a lot of our housing providers. And I'm really worried about that. We heard about, COVID and folks leaving their units. And yes, we did have that happen. And they needed to break their lease. But on the other hand, we're looking at housing providers again of providing everything else, but not getting some kind of monies from that. I wasn't sure if people would be able to apply, if they are students, were they able to apply for Minnesota Rent Help MN, or did that not necessarily hold true? And that would be one of the questions that I have. But mostly it's just, as I look at this, it's like, wow, this is really scary. And rent control especially is very scary for a lot of our folks, myself included, when you have something big that might happen to your unit. When you look at a house, just a single family home, and again, I'm going to use radon, you're looking anywhere from $2,500 to $5,000, depending on how that house is built, how old it is, how you can get through. We're not providing money for that. And then we're just saying that our housing providers can just break a lease and not worry about it. The safety aspect alone is very, very scary to me. We've had some rentals where there was some illegal activities happening. Nobody got hurt, but gosh darn it, sure makes you feel really scared for the neighbors. And of course, we didn't find out till later. But I think that's something that we need to tell our housing providers. We do have your back on some of this, and right now it doesn't feel like it. I get the spirit of the bill, Representative Gomez. I really do. But I'm really scared about what some of these actions could have on a lot of our housing providers and what that might mean. So I understand it'll be laid over and we'll have a chance at it again, but I just really have a lot of angst with it and really I'm really scared about what's gonna happen. Maybe we'll see a lot of what happened in St. Paul when they had their rent control, where we just had a lot of people saying, yeah, I'm not doing this. And that just scares me. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Gomez, for bringing this forward. I think that a number of the provisions in this bill are things that we actually need, particularly in the landlord-tenant area, to make things clear, both for landlords and tenants. One thing I especially appreciate is the mitigation factor. As a lawyer, one of the things that we are taught in property law is that you have a responsibility as a landowner to mitigate your damages when something happens on your property. So this does apply in the rental space, where if for some reason a tenant has to end the lease or if they abandon the property, there is mitigation that is expected that the landlord is supposed to be doing in order to mitigate their damages. So thank you for bringing that provision forward to make it clearer in Minnesota that that is also what we follow, like the rest of the country. I'll also just, you know, continue to highlight, yes, you know, landlords are on the are in the marketplace, they're in the business place, that some of these are the cost of doing business in order to, as many of our colleagues say, provide housing to tenants. But we need to make sure that the playing field is level, that both parties understand their roles. And I think that the bill that Representative Gomez is bringing forward continues to do that and continues to move us in that direction. So as we continue to work on this, I hope that we get it to a point where members can say yes. So thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other hands raised. We have just checking one. Oh, Representative Heinrich, did you have an additional comment?
Trying to unmute there. Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make the point. I know this is probably there's some disagreement there, but you know, housing providers aren't in the business to provide housing. I think that that gets lost sometimes. It is an investment. We need to encourage investment in housing, and that's what's going to keep housing affordable and available for everyone that needs it. So when we talk about level playing field, it's just, you know, it sounds like a kind of a nice thing to say or kind of a buzzword that you can get a lot of support for. And I don't mean to push back too hard because I know the intentions are good, but I just think that it's important that we recognize that people are in business to make a profit, and that's okay. And out of that can come some really good things like affordable housing. We use the term of naturally occurring affordable housing a lot of the time. I don't know who the genius was that made that up, but it's a good term. But I think we all know at some level it's not naturally occurring. There were people that went in and invested in those manufactured home parks originally. And then there was people that that freely made an agreement without government involved, no third party. They make an agreement between that housing provider and the would-be tenant. And the marketplace is set based on that affordability. So just wanted to make that comment. Thank you for the time, Madam Chair. And again, I'd love to chat with Chair Gomez if she will offline in the future. Thank you.
And Representative Gomez, we have literally just a minute or two if you have just a closing thought.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just thankful for all the comments that we received. Happy to continue the conversation. You know, I think that Representative Heinrich really identified one of the drivers of this issue of you know, of eviction, of the unequal balance of power when, you know, we have a situation where something that is a human right, housing, is being used as a source of profit for a lot of people. And so, you know, in that situation where you have one of the basic necessities of human life that is being used as a profit source for folks, then we as the government have an obligation to provide some protection to the folks who are at a power disadvantage, and those are the tenants in this situation. So I just thank you for the consideration, Madam Chair, and my colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. House File 1790, as amended, is laid over. Members, our next meeting will be on Thursday, March 17. There being no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.